Tom, you know, this is, I think, the fourth time the community has gone through this type of process, and I think it deserves a tremendous amount of credit for doing it and for refining it over time. This is a much broader effort than ever before. But before we get into the details of all the issues you discussed, which I'm sure we'll hear about in a minute, my question is more, okay, so the intelligence community deserves a lot of credit for thinking, you know, beyond the immediate horizon. But there are so many things on the immediate horizon, the things that you alluded to that will affect in many, many ways where we'll be in 2025. How do you see, or how would you like to see this used? How do you anticipate this being used other than being presented and the Washington wonks, you know, will use it and will criticize it and will comment on it? But in government, how or if do we have reasonable expectations that the people whose job it is to deal with the present threats today will have the time, the interest, and the capability, let's assume the intellect, to apply this now? What are we expecting this to accomplish today?
It's a great question. The timing of these reports is deliberate, that we'd like to get it to new members of a new administration or a last time around, a re-elected but replenishing itself administration. New officials coming in with agendas, with expectations, to catch them in that window before they are consumed by the inbox and the press of day-to-day events. To think a little more about the world outside of their portfolio, the way in which events that are in a job jar of other officials might affect them, to link up their own aspirations and policies and concerns to those of others, to begin to think about potential allies, to be able to anticipate foreign reactions to it. But our audience is not just the new administration. One of the things that we learned, quite to our surprise, actually, with the earlier ones, was the appetite in the United States and abroad to this kind of stimulative document. That 2020 was translated into several languages. It's used in college classrooms around the world. It's used as a World Affairs Council kind of discussion groups. And it does contribute to that sort of broader informed public in ways that are beneficial. It's secondary, but we have in our heads that this was the way it played out the last time and is likely to again. That the a connection between, you know, way out there in 2025 and what people have to worry about today and tomorrow. In its broadest compass, is if you project events going in a particular trajectory on individual issues or woven together, we have some suggestive scenarios in this that are appealing to you. You'd like the world of 2025 to have at least some of the dimensions that are projected, to be able to ask oneself and ask the policy, what do I need to do now to keep things on a positive trajectory? Or if one doesn't like the prediction or the projection, the scenario, the suggestion as to where it is going, to make a choice other than to simply dismiss this as the ravings of the Intel weenies, who probably don't know what they're talking about anyway.
I've been called worse.
Yeah, I think we all have. But to say, if I don't like it, where do I have the best chance to influence events, to bring them in a more positive direction? What are the things that I might do individually or unilaterally? What are the things that can only be done with cooperation of other nations? What are the things can best be done through multilateral mechanisms? And something I didn't mention at all in this, which is the non-state actors. We see non-state actors as being very important. So it's an effort to broaden the discussion, expand thinking, expand the palette of possible alternative actions, and at least to be suggestive of points of intervention without recommending any particular course of action.
I was struck, Maury Amate, I was struck of a lack of any discussion of what, particularly in the Middle East, what the religious trend could look like. Mm-hmm. With all the young people, with disaffection, with all the problems, would this be a fertile ground for the spread of militant Islam? Is this a threat that will be lessened, or do you think it could become very large? I would think looking ahead to 2025, where Islam will be, what its role will be in the Middle East and in near areas could be very crucial.
Yeah, I mean, did we look at that specifically? No. And indeed, I should make clear that my talk today goes considerably beyond 2025. I've taken some broad trends and thought about them in terms of the Middle East. So you ought to think of this as fingers take as of today on some of these issues, not a recitation of where the report comes down. It's not inconsistent with it. But this is a question that I think is indicative of many, that there are implications, depending on where one comes down, that for greater or lesser tolerance within the region of populations, of whether or not the demographics will affect this, how it affects the quality of education. There are, of course, again, within this time frame, differences within Islam, within the Sunni school, Sunni Shia, Iranian influence, and is that separable from Shia organizations, that will play out in this region as very much a part of the stew that will shape events. So you're absolutely correct in identifying it as an important dimension, but it is one on which I'll defer to the room as to how it will play out.
Yes?
I'm Dan Pollack from the Zionist Organization of America. I think in the Bible, a prophet is to be judged by how well they do at predicting the future. I think the bad news there is, if you're wrong, I think they stoned you. But anyway, can we go back to like 1990 and take a look at how well we predicted the world of today?
Mm-hmm.
I guess 1990-91 would be the equivalent time frame. And in particular, I'm just thinking out loud about we didn't really understand, I don't think, in 1990 very well the role the internet would play in today's world. I don't think Islamic fundamentalism was fully appreciated. I mean, going through all those things,
mm-hmm.
and maybe learn a lesson from how we looked from then to now about how we might look from now to the future.
It's an absolutely correct observation. Indeed, we have a box in here, which I've forgotten the precise title, but it's sort of the need for modesty in this kind of projection that runs through going back to before World War I, sort of expectations of what the world would be like and the key dynamics. And they're universally wrong. They missed everything that was important. And policies were set up around them. The next sentence here has to do with leadership. And I didn't mention that except very tangentially. So if we judge both that longer historic record and in looking at the uncertainties where policy can make a difference here. Good policies that produce beneficial results or lead to different outcomes than bad policies or unsuccessful policy might be a good idea but poorly executed, and that leadership really matters. And part of the message we're attempting to convey here is that, you know, leaders can shape events, that this is not immutable. The future is subject to influence at the margins or to a greater extent. So this is not a understand it, accept it. There's nothing you can do about it. Indeed, the message I would like to get across is precisely the opposite.
Thanks very much. It's Steve Erlanger from the New York Times. I want to try to press you for a little bit more specificity. I'm here. Sorry. When you're talking about demographics, I agree that's crucial. And if you, for argument's sake, if you look at Gaza, 58% of people now are, you know, under the age of 18. So are you presuming in the next period till 2025 these trends continue as they are today? Or do you assume that there will be more education, a bit more wealth, smaller families? I mean, you have to have made that kind of decision. And could you explain what you decided and why?
No. Not simply because, you know, not doing the rollout of the report, but because, in fact, we didn't go into that kind of the demography as a gross variable. Sort of numbers of birth, relative age, size of age cohorts, the things that are sort of fixed, that we took from the demographers. What they took, that if I didn't make it clear in my presentation, that what kind of education is provided, what kind of opportunities, what kind of jobs are available, what kind of safety valves through the political system are provided, will have a tremendous impact on whether this is a benefit and a resource for a particular country or region, or an albatross, an anchor, a constraint on moving forward. That the what is more fixed is size and relative size of age cohorts. So what one does with that as a government, as a society, within religious organizations, foreign investors that are come in to see this as a source of relatively inexpensive, if talented, and trained labor, or hopelessly undereducated to meet the demands. That's where choice makes a difference.
No judgments about whether the trends were toward more employment, better education, or not?
No.
Marvin,
hi, Marvin.
Okay. There you go. Got it. Okay. Tom, rather than the biblical prophet that we've heard, what about a Hellenistic Cassandra? Did you have to? Could you, let me put it this way, can you avoid taking into consideration here the kind of traumas, shocks to the system from global armed conflict, from panic epidemics, which are all too possible, from major global depression, environmental disasters, and so on? Can one make the kind of straight line projections that you have, and avoid at least looking at the consequence of such events on the global system?
Yeah. I think if one were to simply take sort of the trajectories that we have focused on here, it's very easy to get Cassandra-like, hand-wringing. It just gets harder and harder to deal with these problems. But the intent, as well as the aspiration for this report, is that it has a certain grabbing people's attention, that this is not inevitable, that these are issues, they are among the issues, not just the ones I talked about here, but the longer list that's in there. They're among the issues that will cry out for attention, or a far-sighted leader can seize upon to make a difference or try to make a difference, to find partners or not find partners to work it. And that sort of having teed up the issue, resolution is more likely than if it were ignored or obscured by an exhaustive catalog of all of the things that any leadership is going to have to deal with. You know me, Marvin, I am an optimist, a perennial optimist, and I would be dismayed if either my talk today or when it comes out, the 2020, or is read as a woe is me, we're headed for the cliff, maybe we're already going over the cliff, and all we could do is manage the intensity of our impact at the bottom. That's, I think, not where I view things headed. I think we're smarter than to succumb to the most dire implications of this kind of study and sort of believe that discussion, debate, argumentation, that there are a lot of possible ameliorating, mitigating strategies that even if partially successful, will lead to a future that is not nearly as dire as if one straight-lined all the negative ones.
Pam Hess over here with AP. Could you, sort of following on that, which of the trends do you think are reversible and which of the trends do you think are inevitable and action has to be taken to sort of mitigate their consequences?
Yeah. I'm going to probably appear because I will be ducking the question in some respects, but the demography probably comes as close to inevitable as anything that I've talked about today. But that said, one can imagine lots of ways of responding to, adapting to, managing that phenomenon. That energy will be important. That's probably pretty certain, but how important, at what price, to which segments of the demand side or the producing side of the equation is a function of decisions that potentially are yet to be made.
Hasan Hazar, Türkiye Daily. What is Turkey's role as a regional power and as an ally of NATO and possibly EU member, and also some resources of food and water going to be in the near future of the Middle East?
If others didn't hear, what's the role of Turkey, EU, NATO membership, source of water? Clearly, by virtue of Turkey's location, size, the resource endowment that it has, the prospects over this time period, for different types of engagement with the EU will be a significant factor in the way events play out. But again, we didn't look in detail at specific countries. We hope others will, and I certainly lack the expertise to give even an informed guess in response to the specificity of your question.
Just to communicate back to you, all of you have been showing hands. I see you. I'm going in the order roughly that I saw you. So right here, please.
Bob Kopakin, you've mentioned energy several times. I'm going to pin you down and ask a very specific question about two or three studies, which I wonder if you consulted. Shell Oil International does a series of scenarios, and they've usually been pretty good. They look out 20 to 30 years in advance. Another study was done by Chatham House, John Mitchell, on the transformation of the energy producers from commodities to others. And basically their conclusion, and this was done in consulting, with consulting finance from the Asian Development Bank, they're not running out of oil, but they are running out of time. And there are human resource constraints upon their ability to convert from commodities to others. Peak oil. Did you examine peak oil as a concept?
I can't answer that in confidence. I know the Shell ones were looked at. And one of the reasons is, and it's a chance to make a larger point about the way in which we did this, that we had lots of studies that were done for us on specific topics, one of which was energy, and some seminars done in the teams that organized that. I hope, I would guess, have looked at all of these, but by the time it was distilled down, where I became involved, I wasn't reading specific studies.
Tom, can you give access to a mic over there somewhere?
Tom Gelton of NPR. I'm going to challenge your optimism here a little bit. You talked about you predicted the increasing inability, excuse me, of international institutions to solve problems. With respect to the Middle East, does that inevitably add up to a recipe for more conflict, or is it possible that other institutions or other interests somehow emerge that give countries in the Middle East some alternative way to address their problems? Because it's given that that's going to be the arc of instability, if international institutions are failing, that adds up to a pretty dire outlook, it seems to me.
I'm going to give an indirect answer to the question. That among the alternatives that we sketch out, and alternatives is actually too strong, among the possible lines of development that we suggest is the development of regional organizations on a regional free trade association, because it's too hard to get agreement and put in place a new institution at a global scale. And there are a series of if-then kind of thinking or kind of judgments that go into this, but that if the folks in a region decide that the best way to manage their challenges of whatever kind, economic, literacy, security, and so on, climate change, that they decide that they're going to work that regionally, that will be eminently feasible and maybe increasingly likely. But let me leave it at that.
Jim Mannion from Agence France-Presse. Dr. Finger, you touched very lightly, I thought, on the problem of terrorism.
Problem of terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Is that because you would expect terrorism to recede in the kind of prominence that it's had in the past 8 years as other problems come to the fore?
Yeah, there's both a relative and an absolute dimension to your question. That partly it is the heuristic character of this that in effect says you've got to pay attention to these other developments, which isn't these are more important than terrorism. It's just you've got to look at them. Partly there is an interactive character, as I was suggesting about the youth education responsiveness of regimes. But we also explore terrorism in a way that my statement here, not attributing it directly to the report, terrorism kind of writ large has less appeal, less recruitment, sort of less of a problem. Again, the waning appeal of international al-Qaeda kind of ideology, but more dangerous. And this has to do with relative availability of biological agents, that the lethality of conventional munitions, one can imagine sort of in the aggregate the threat diminishes, but specific instances being much more deadly.
Behind the pillar.
Stuart Sloan. You mentioned education in context of development of a country, and specifically you mentioned that, like many people do, that it's essential to educate both sexes in order for a country to reach its full development. But I'd like you to comment on the resource aspect, which you also touched upon, of that given. Wouldn't it be realistic or pragmatic for a leader to say, I don't have the resources to educate all the young, both sexes, and therefore, if I could construct or continue to have cultural and religious impediments to educating women such that they keep them down on the farm, so to speak, and they wouldn't revolt, wouldn't it be more efficient to devote my resources, my limited resources, and more importantly, the jobs that might be able to be developed towards just the male?
Could be. I mean, one can certainly imagine governments making that choice or use some other discriminating mechanism. We're only going to educate those who are in cities. We'll catch up with the countryside later. We're only going to educate those of a particular property-owning status because they will have more wherewithal and incentives and support mechanisms. Again, one can imagine a lot of criteria for discrimination in the distribution of a scarce resource. How individual countries make that decision, how confident they are in their legitimacy, how confident they are in having the support of the public in doing that, and what lessons they have learned or failed to learn from other parts of the globe. And again, the global communications revolution, let me overstate it, there's no excuse for any leadership anywhere being ignorant about what has worked or not worked in other contexts as a starting point for saying, what lesson should I draw from that? Is my situation all that different? Might I learn from it? That I think the array of the possible is wider than we'll continue to do what we have always justified, and we'll do it in the name of accelerated progress up the education ladder, the technology ladder, the scale or the type of modernization that we undertake.
Kind of the back of this middle lab. There you go.
Is what are the political forces in that region? If indeed we knew that the Soviets were coming into power, we knew what to expect from them. After the French Revolution, we could tell what's going on. In the United States, given the fact that we have a limited number of parties, we know what the choices are. What are the political choices and what are the political forces in that country? Because you talk about leaders. Well, a leader is a leader who needs masses to follow him. So what are the political forces that we might face, and what can we expect?
Yeah, I don't know. I'll guess. Indeed, essentially, almost all of the dialogue has been you posing questions, me tossing out ideas, that others should have different ideas. There's no more authoritative because I said them than anybody else, and probably less so. But again, this is to stimulate thinking, and that's an absolutely apt question. That might it be politics triggered by the death of individual leaders? Long ruling, well liked, who provide sort of a cushion and an inertia that a successor would not have. That I think it's a fair observation in sort of the part of the world that you folks look at, that there are not very many well-defined political party-like mechanisms for aggregating and adjudicating, moderating political issues. That the strongest one in many parts is the Muslim Brotherhood. If one looks to the 91 election in Algeria, the election of Hamas, that there are certain sort of reasons to be less than euphoric about the prospects for an electoral-based outcome. But how do political concerns get expressed? Who mobilizes them? Is it religion? Is it a charismatic leader unique because he or she isn't invoking religion as the underpinning for legitimacy of the characterization? Is there I have a better idea? Is it influenced by forces outside of the country or completely indigenous? Or religious debates or ethnic disagreements or conflict for economic resources sort of really played out in a political arena? They translated into political demands on the system that come out as sort of a regional, almost secessionist agenda. All of this, I think, and a lot more, is possible in part because there isn't a very clear, very strong sort of network of multiple vehicles for organizing political activity, and that's one of the hallmarks of the region.
Thank you, Jonathan Rausch of National Journal Magazine. It's probably fair to say that the last several administrations have paid more time and attention and military and diplomatic capital to the Middle East than they would have liked. Have you looked at whether the relative importance of the Middle East region will rise, decline, or stay the same over the course of the period?
No, we haven't. And that... if the characterization, gross to be sure, of area of instability and as a locus for energy resources, if those two dimensions are right and remain salient, the Middle East will get attention. Has to. But exactly how that plays out, I don't have either a crystal ball or a clear notion.
Either back, Mike?
Hi. I have a clarification and a question. When you were speaking about terrorism before, was that terrorism generally or al-Qaeda? And my second question is, how do you see the high price of oil emboldening a country like Iran and making it more difficult for us to exert pressure on them in the future?
Mm-hmm. I was speaking very broad brush about terrorism and probably more al-Qaeda than any other particular group. That does money embolden Iran or other, does embolden Russia, does embolden Hugo Chavez in Venezuela? Is probably a pretty simple-minded but accurate proposition. If you've got more money, you have more possibility, more self-assurance, more capacity to buy off internal dissatisfaction, more capacity to influence groups outside of the border, more capacity to invest in weaponry or more beneficent sources of national power or manifestations of national power, that absolute amount of earnings, how much money is available, seems to me must be run through the lens or the screen of character of national leadership, whether this is a an opportunity to address some of the internal challenges, to move up the ladder of capacity of the population to address regional inequities or other inequities within to provide better health care, better social security system for old age that will affect population size and growth. Question was asked earlier. That it comes back to leadership. Leadership of individuals, leadership of sort of ruling elite, responsiveness of leaders to key groups within their political sense. I don't think it is a simple, the more money a problem state has, the more trouble it makes. That one can at least imagine developments that would increase its stake in the region, increase its involvement in the international system in a way that would actually decrease its scope for making mischief.
Elaine Grossman with the National Journal Group's Global Security Newswire. I wanted to come back to the nuclear issue, if you would. First, I wanted to see if you established a connection of any sort between the provision of Western assistance in terms of material or technological aid in the nuclear, civil nuclear sector, to then nations in the Middle East region becoming nuclear armed in the future. And secondly, along those lines, did you make any projections or any sort of ranges of projections about how many nuclear powers there might be in 2025 in that region?
No, actually, we didn't. We didn't. They're both very good questions, but in 100 pages, we did not do everything. Well, having earlier in my career been involved in arms control programs and projects, that civil nuclear provides opportunities for certain kinds of technology to be mastered. That is a necessary but not sufficient criteria or condition for moving into weapons. But there are a lot of countries with civil nuclear capacity that don't have weapons programs, haven't had weapons program. It's not a, if you can do this, you're going to do that. And some, most under the NPT, have renounced both the intent and the capacity.
Rafi Danziger from APAC. You spoke briefly about the water shortage, which indeed is one of the most severe problems affecting the area and is bound to get even more severe because of demography and other reasons. You also mentioned in passing the issue of desalination. And the question is, since desalination already is mature technology and the price has really come down quite dramatically, unlike alternatives to oil, for instance, and some countries, Israel, Gulf countries, already taken some serious steps to move forward on that issue. Do you think that this could be a long-term solution to the problem, or it's going to be only on the margins and the shortage is going to remain for the next 20 years one of the biggest issues affecting the Middle East?
It's probably not the solution, but it certainly could alleviate, could buy time, could create a context within which the room to maneuver, to negotiate, to have swaps, and so forth would be increased on it. Sort of at what expense, the safety dimensions of this, the fuel disposal and all of those kinds of issues that would need to be addressed. But it not just it could be, I suspect it probably will be a part of the equation. Whether it is a big part or a small part, I don't know.
Dimitri with the Financial Times. We've gone from a world of two superpowers to more recently one superpower. As the last weekend, the G20 meeting showed, the tectonic plates of power are shifting. How do you see the balance of power in the world in 2025? Is it going to be two superpowers, the US and China, multi-powers, blocks of power? What does it look like?
Multi-power. And historically, multi-power eras have been less stable than either. Bipolar balance of power or unipolar.
Thank you. From CBS, just following on that, I know you're talking about the Middle East today. You recently gave a speech, I think, where you talked a little bit, teeing up the report, about how the U.S. intersects all this. Can you just talk briefly about the change in the U.S. military national defense complex going forward, how that is effective or not effective in dealing with future threats? And what about cyber?
What about?
Cyber.
Let me take the cyber one first. Cyber, as my boss, Mike McConnell, has said on many occasions, is a very, very serious security challenge to the United States because of the interconnected character of banking, our economy, power grids, and everything else. But the potential for damage and disruption, and what, 96-98% of all of the cyber world is in the private sector. So sort of managing this is a big challenge, or safeguarding its integrity is a big, big challenge. On U.S. military configuration, I would be so far exceeding my own areas of competence that I don't even want to guess on it, other than making the point that has been made by others, including Secretary Gates, that the way we have configured and equipped and trained in the past is not appropriate to the likely security challenges we're going to have in the future.
Could you just explain why that is? I mean, that's what I'm not getting.
That in the world as it is now, as the world projected out to 2025, sort of small scale clashes, humanitarian vulnerabilities within them, resource disputes that are low level, almost policing, increased urbanization, that the sort of what you see in Baghdad, it may be what is seen in the future, not the armies go off on the plains and disrupt agricultural production, but don't go near the cities except for the massive bombing like in World War II, that would seem to require different kinds of mobility, different kinds of defenses against IEDs or other sort of man-portable kind of weaponry rather than a clash of tanks, a clash of fighter aircraft. That's what occurs to me by that characterization.
Hi, Randy Mickelson with Reuters. A lot of what you've been describing this afternoon seems like extrapolation of existing trends, but I'm wondering if you saw any germs, or seeds, things that haven't developed really maybe into a trend yet, but that might in the future, that that might become forces none of us are aware of at the moment. And I'm wondering, B, if you took any just flights of fancy and said, you know, this could happen without any real evidence now.
Well, that sort of running through all of this is the my answer to this man's question about earlier projections, that that this is not a forecast. This is not a prediction. That history is replete with missing the big developments. Could one imagine a technological breakthrough that suddenly made it possible to run automobiles on sand? I'm obviously being facetious, but given the pace of change over the last decade, it would seem to be more prudent than imprudent to hold that possibility out there. Technological change, though unpredictable, may be more likely than dramatic political breakthroughs in there. That changing international organizations, changing political cultures, changing political structures is kind of slow and often painful. I'm tempted to say that the entire exercise is an episode of whimsy here. I'm not trying to be facetious, that for analysts whose day job is to stick pretty close to the evidence, to work the real problems that we are charged with addressing, to look out into the future where we don't have the kind of information. You know, we have no intelligence on Mother Nature's plans for hurricanes or typhoons. But massive flooding in portions of the world could have a big impact on attitudes and behavior. So there is a sort of a need to suspend the normal way of doing business. And Chris Kochum is back there, and he was with me back when we did some of the earliest of the lookout 15 years. And it was really hard to get analysts to do that. So having gone through it, a large proportion said, this is really good. I learned to think differently. I opened up sort of my receptors to a different kind of input, better able to consider the what if, the things that would be game changers, or if not dealt with adequately, events that could deflect from a most likely trajectory. So in that sense, the entire exercise, as indeed the discussion today where you're playing stump the band with me, I'm thinking out loud. My ability to think out loud here is either good or bad. You will judge that. But it's certainly influenced by wrestling with these kinds of questions in the course of preparing 2025 and its predecessors. And a goal of this is to get a much larger segment of the attentive public to do some of this kind of thinking and be prepared to ask the kind of questions that you are asking me, to answer those questions to yourself, to the groups with which you associate, to challenge our political leadership in a way that, you know, their answers matter, mine don't. I mean, mine is just, you know, another pointy-headed intellectual speculating in a room full of people. But there are other folks whose decisions could matter on this.
By my count, we have four questions left. We can make them short questions and short answers, starting with Simon in the back, and I think we might be able to get through all of them.
Simon Henderson, the Washington Institute. Taking on your most recent comments, was there any consideration that you would delay the implication of your report, because events like the collapse in the price of oil or the financial and economic crisis had occurred, and if there wasn't any discussion over delaying it, what sort of event would, in your imagination, have caused that delay?
There were some who urged us to take the time to try and more carefully factor in the global financial crisis. And indeed, in recent weeks, we've convened a lot more sessions than we had anticipated, specifically to focus on this issue. And in the end, so put it in there as a flag, put it in there in part to say some of our projections about the waning ability of existing institutions to deal with the problem sort of got here faster than we had anticipated. But the timeline for this is to have it out after the election and as early as we could to get it into the hands of people beginning to move into new positions of authority. So there was never on my part, and since as the chairman of the NIC, I was determinative on this, no serious consideration to delaying this. I supervised graduate students in a previous life, and I got to read one more book, and that, we will never know all that we need to know. Let's get it out there and treat it as an iterative process. What kind of event would have caused us to stop the presses? I can't imagine one, actually.
Okay, let's take, if we can, both of our last two questions here in the front left, and then, Tom, if you, after both of them, we can answer them. Okay.
Hi, Jeff Bliss from Bloomberg News. I just wanted to clarify, are you saying that terrorism will become less attractive in the future, or are you saying it will continue to be less attractive to the population at large? Second question is, do you plan to stay on in your current position?
Until 2025?
We'll do a near-term
projection.
Okay, thanks. Dave Pollack, Washington Institute. One of the words that I don't think you mentioned is war. And looking back at the last several generations mm-hmm. and looking ahead at what many people think might happen in the shorter term, in the next 5 years, let's say, that has greatly transformed the Middle East and also sometimes been completely inconclusive, is war between various parties in the region or between outside powers and countries in the region. What do you think about the prospects of that over the next 15 or 20 years?
Mm-hmm. Terrorism, actually many different levels of cut in here. That the kind of the appeal of terrorist arguments that facilitates raising money, recruitment, tolerance, I think is waning. That most of this is sort of killing Muslims, killing women and children, is actually losing appeal. But the demographics of a larger cohort that may be arguably more alienated as a potential recruitment base, that even though the percentage that would actually be recruitable, it remains very small. It's a very small percentage of a larger number. War clearly is a potential disruptor. And we kind of tap danced around that. And I will appear to be doing so in responding, but it is that there are more potential sources of conflict, some of them around resource availability in the context of arguably reduced capacity of existing sort of mechanisms to deal with those conflicts of interest creates at least the potential for resort to arms in there. And again, depending on where one comes down as the likely capacity of political mechanisms internal to the region and external to the region 17 years from now, you can think that the potential for military clashes goes up, stays the same, or goes down. And again, the most important point of all, once that question is put on the agenda to think about it, what would one want to do now to reduce the likelihood that a conflict over water, for example, results in a military clash? In 2025, I will be 79.